Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One, and we're really glad you've taken time this St. Patrick's Day weekend to come join us here for the next hour. As a reminder to those that are joining us live, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, you'll find the chat room. That's a good place to roll in with the usual suspects from Turkey to all other places in between. I don't think we have our token Canadian yet, but he usually shows up before it's done. And if you have to leave halfway through the show and you want to catch what you missed, you can always get this or other shows over at the Blog Talk Radio website where we have the full archive available for downloading to listen to at your convenience. Now let's get on with the show. We've had a few episodes in the last 3 years where we've dedicated to talking about education, the intellectual development of our leaders. And we're going to wander into that venue again today from just a slightly different angle. And as we advance the intellectual development of our leaders through professional military education, whether it's at the Naval War College or other locations, it's always important to look and make sure that we're trying to achieve the goals and that we're doing it the best that we can, not just to serve the Navy, but also to serve the nation, because ultimately it's that intellectual development that results in programs, policy, advice to the commander-in-chief, and that intellectual development is absolutely critical in order to have something not only that is relevant, but that is effective. And our guest today for the full hour to discuss this and more is Dr. Joan Johnson-Free. She's a professor of national security affairs at the Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. Dr. Johnson-Free, welcome to Midrats.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you. And I thought just as a scene setter, because a lot of our listeners may not be aware of your background, just to start things off, I wonder if you could tell us, what is your role at the Naval War College and what is your core area of specialty?
Okay. Well, first of all, let me say, Sal, I thought you introduced the topics very well. You really got the context of this is all about doing the best we can for the military officers and for the nation. So thank you for that. I am a professor of national security affairs at the Naval War College. I came here in 2002, and for 8 years I was the department chair. I've now gone back to the faculty, and at the Naval War College, as at most of the war colleges, you know, there are the three departments, military operations and strategy and policy, which deals with a lot of the strategy issues from a historical context. And then there's national security affairs, which is very much a combination of political science, international relations, economics, and all those things you need to succeed on a Washington tour and abroad. So it's kind of a compilation course. My particular area, my doctorate is in political science and international relations, and I teach in both the strategy course and the leadership course. We just got finished with our winter semester, and I taught the senior seminar in leadership, which I enjoy very much. Now, having said that, my research area for many years, for 20-plus years, has been, there's been kind of two arcs in my research field, and the first and foremost has been in the area of space security. I have written many books and many articles on space security issues, dealing from missile defense to export control. I'm going this Wednesday, as a matter of fact, to testify before the Senate Commerce Committee on assessing risks and threats and opportunities to the U.S. in space, and we'll be dealing with issues from geostrategic issues to the future of NASA. So there's this space arc that has really traversed my career. And the second is globalization. And I've stayed, or I've gotten involved in globalization out of interest that stemmed from traveling a lot through the Naval War College. While I was department chair, we have very active, or we had a very aggressive and active international engagement program where faculty teams would go to other war colleges in countries from Uruguay to Cameroon, South Africa, Ethiopia, and work with their war colleges to develop curriculum. And the issues that I saw that really affect politics and international relations and the globalization really caught my interest. And I was able to develop that and integrate it into my classes at the Naval War College. And I also teach classes on space and security and globalization and U.S. national interest at Harvard Summer School and Harvard Extension School. So the only other thing I would add was that I have been doing professional military education for 20 years, starting at the Air War College, and then I spent some time in Honolulu at the Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies, and then came to the Naval War College. So this book that we're going to talk about today is based on my 20 years experience at several institutions and my view that this is important. I wouldn't have been doing it for 20 years if it wasn't really important. And therefore, as you said, we need to do the best job we can.
And I forgot to mention at the opening, just so everybody is clear, Dr. Johnson-Freeze, she's on today, representing herself. Any opinions that she may have are strictly hers and don't necessarily represent those of the Naval War College, the Navy, the U.S. government, or perhaps even the host, but she's here with us. Eagle One,
thank
over
you
to you.
For that.
Yeah. Why do we have professional military education, and what's the benefit to the country?
Well, I think Sal said it best. This is an increasingly complex world where we call upon our military to be more than war fighters. There is a great quote at in the Naval War College. Well, we have all kinds of quotes that we cite all the time, but you are not just asked to fight wars. You are asked to keep the peace and to prepare to keep the world in a state where we are able to protect ourselves with perhaps not going to war. And that requires a broader catalog of expertise than in the past. I mean, in the past, we didn't expect our military officers to have an awareness, a working awareness of different religions, of nationalism and what that meant to the military, to regional studies and why culture is important. But now all of that is part of the toolkit that an officer needs as they rise in rank, that when you get to Washington, you need a broader range of capabilities than those which allow you to be to succeed at the tactical and the operational level. And so the war colleges take individuals who are very well trained. I mean, our military officers and are the best trained officers in the world, hands down. But it takes that well-trained individual and takes them to a higher strategic level through a broad, more liberal education than they might have had in the past. So many of our officers, their background is in engineering or in a kind of a hard science background, that this exposure to the liberal arts topics, sometimes it's for the very first time, these will be the tools that they will need in the future. So it's this taking officers to the strategic level. The benefit to the country? Well, again, it's the idea that it's better to have someone prepared to prevent war and have them prepared to fight it if necessary. So it's this combination of the two.
You mentioned a real interesting point. It's been one of my hobby horses, really, since I've been a midshipman. In the more years I spent in the Navy, the more apparent it became from an ensign during Desert Storm to winding things up in Kabul before I became a civilian. And it's that, and it's a definite bias in the way that we train our officers, encourage them, and that's that bias towards a technical education. I know a junior officer who I first became acquainted with when he was a midshipman. I believe his major was in philosophy of all things, but he's a nuclear engineer. He was able to do that just fine. But this overly aggressive bias towards technical degrees, what I found manifested in itself, it wasn't the simple irritating things of not having a department head or a division officer who can actually do a 5-paragraph essay. It was a larger understanding of cultural context, history, why people do things, how the interactions and interplays of individuals and institutions can work on a variety of levels. And there's been some great articles over, especially the last 5 or 6 years since we got engaged in this decade of war, perhaps readdressing that that conflict that we seem to have in the Navy with that bias towards technical education. Do you see that needle moving any at least? I'm focused more on the undergraduate level right now. Or is that bias towards having to have such a high percentage of engineers out there so institutionalized that it's not moving?
I think it's the latter. I think it is very institutionalized. The military in general, there's a wealth of literature on this topic. The military in general is very technically oriented, the sense of technicism. But it really blossomed after World War II. Before World War II, there was a tradition for officers to have a general liberal education first and then become technically savvy later. But as the United States military became more and more dependent on and really benefited by technology, I don't mean to demean technology at all, but space is my field especially. But as increasingly there was nuclear ships, satellites, different types of weaponry that was very very high tech, there was this reversal of technical education first, foremost, and continually. Unfortunately as well, the technical education tends to be more, I don't want to say training, but more right and wrong answer oriented, which is exactly the opposite of what you were talking about in terms of cultural context and questions to which there may not be specific answers or right and wrong answers, but a variety of answers. And unfortunately as well, I think this is one of the areas where we're currently seeing a disconnect between rhetoric and action at the very higher levels of those who are responsible for military education. There is a lot of rhetoric about the need to have our officers have a broader education, but in the kind of minutes of the meeting and briefings on meetings that I was able to see as chair, and more recently, when push came to shove, there is a real push at the higher levels for officers with more technical training. And it's not just in the Navy, but it is foremost in the Navy.
Well, that kind of raises one of the questions I have, which is we seem to have a whole lot of war colleges, Army, Air Force, whatever they call it, Navy, plus all these other, industrial war college in the United States, all these other ones. Do we need that many? Are the needs of each service so unique that they have to have their own war college?
Well, I would look at it a little differently. I see the rationale for the different services having different war colleges, their own war college, because it's at the Naval War College, we definitely, our curriculum has a naval flair to it. You know, we focus not only on joint professional military education, but naval professional military education, and certainly the Army wants to do the same. when I was at the Air War College, there was discussion, I was in on discussions where they were coming up with their new mission statement, and they were actually discussing having something like creation of air power zealots, you know, as part of the mission statement. So there is this service emphasis. Where I see the bigger waste, for a lack of a better word, and the bigger potential for savings is the Naval War College. We teach both the intermediate command and staff course and the senior war college course. One building, one faculty, we do it all. But the other services have entirely separate facilities for the intermediate course and for the senior course, which is why the Naval War College costs about a third of what the other war colleges cost per student. There is just a huge savings to be had to combine these two curricula. There is, having taught at the Air War College, the faculty is not overtaxed that they couldn't teach both, and that's shown by the fact that that's exactly what we do here in Newport. So I think that keeping the service-designated war colleges has a much stronger justification than there is for having two schools for the intermediate and senior course.
I think it's also kind of a nice competitive environment where one particular service can go in a certain direction, and if it doesn't work out, they can look to other institutions who might be doing it better, as opposed to having one that if it goes down the wrong direction, then everybody suffers. A little bit of competition is good in that respect. And the reviews to your book that came out late last year, and anybody can go over on Amazon, do a quick search under Joan Johnson Freeze at Educate America's Military. One of the reviewers, Diane Mazur from University of Florida, brought up a nice little bullet that I wish that I had coined. She talked about taking on the PowerPointed echo chamber of military education. I think that PowerPointed echo chamber, you see it not only that, but in non-academic publication, whether you're looking at proceedings or somebody writes for a different type of publication, where you have different individuals who seem to be parroting the same idea, that shock of shock, when you look who owns paper on them, that's what their boss is supporting, or that's the main line of thought. And I exchanged some emails with officers on a regular basis, and I felt this myself when I was on active duty, that people will hand me things and say, hey, could you publish this? Because I wanted to write an article about it, but I think it would be career-ending for me. There's a fair bit of... I guess a nice way of putting it is intellectual pressure on people, that there are certain approved subjects and ideas and there are other non-approved subjects. In certain subject areas, you are allowed to discuss X, Y, but do not discuss Z, because Z is what Admiral Umpty France does not think people need to be talking about, so they won't do that. And you've had, between the Air Force and the Navy, and you've been around the uniformed people a lot, you get from lieutenants and higher officers coming through. Do you see a difference both over time amongst the officer corps from when you first started to now, and perhaps between the different services, on people's willingness to put themselves and their ideas out there, willing to take the slings and arrows of opinions? I know Admiral Stavridis, you know, has always encouraged people to do that, because he's like, hey, I got nasty phone calls too, but look what I did. Have you seen any changes over the years, or has it been pretty consistent?
Actually, I see that as an area where we're getting better, where there is far more student willingness to speak up. During the years when I was department chair, one of the things that we did, it was standard practice, it was standard operating procedures to take our student papers and make them available through DTIC for others to view. And the view was, well, gee, there were these students who had all this intellectual time and space to write, and we ought to make that available. We ought to just spread it out to anybody who's interested. This is a way of sharing the wealth. Well, what that also did was mean that students had to be very careful about what they wrote, because You didn't know who was going to see it. I remember very specifically a student coming to me and saying he wanted to write a paper in support of diesel submarines, but he viewed that as very risky to his career. And when I could assure him that we no longer put the papers on DTIC, that it would be read by no one but me unless he wanted to publish it, he felt then intellectually free to write about what he wanted to write about. But I know of another example that's in my book at the Air War College not too long ago of one of the students wrote a paper that was basically criticizing the, I think it was our nuclear posture, and a flock of officers above him in rank came out publicly and berated him in a publication. He had published the paper, and they came back with a rebuttal which basically said, sit down and shut up. So I think students are more willing to do that, but they are more willing when there is some cover that it won't ruin their career. And even when there isn't that assurance, they're willing to take the risk. I know the Naval War College, we have a student-run publication. But some of the papers that I read in there, you know, I think, wow, good for you. Good for you for being willing to speak up and say what you think. So I see a real progress in that area.
And, that touches on the whole concept of academic freedom. And I let me kind of put it to you from both the faculty and the student positions. How much academic freedom do you all have as the faculty? And you've already discussed, I guess, to a certain extent, the level of freedom the students have. Either they ignore whatever threat they may feel may be there, or they succumb to it. But how about from your position? How much freedom do you have?
Well, I really think the Naval War College is the flagship academically of the PME institutions because of our academic freedom. I mean, first of all, if we didn't have academic freedom, I would not have been writing a book called Educating America's Military and basically critiquing the institution I work in and the institutional system and structure that I work in. So we have a considerable amount of academic freedom, and it's something that our provost and our presidents have always been very protective of, and I'm very, very grateful for that. That is not always the case, and it's not something that we can take for granted. I receive emails because of the book. I receive a lot of emails from junior faculty members and from faculty members who feel they can't speak up as I have. And the reason I was able to speak up in particular is not just academic freedom, but I have one of the very, very, very few tenured positions at the Naval War College. I don't have to be afraid if I say something that is not liked by the administrators, I'm going to find my contract not renewed because I am tenured. So I receive a lot of emails, and apparently right now at the Naval Postgraduate School, there are discussions going on about potentially having faculty research vetted. Now, you know, what that means, certainly when you go to work for DOD, there is this right to have things vetted for security purposes. My testimony for this Wednesday is currently with the Office of Legislative Affairs to be read through for security issues. But beyond that, what would it be vetted for? For whether it's politically correct, for whether this is a topic that the Navy wanted to discuss, and who would do this? Who would do it? The Public Affairs Office? They certainly don't have the substantive expertise. So this idea of even considering vetting faculty publications is just bureaucracy run amok, a horror story, the worst of all worlds. What it would lead to is any faculty member who was able would be leaving immediately. There wouldn't be enough paper in the Xerox machines for all the resumes that would be sent out. And that, in turn, would hurt the quality of the education, and the whole purpose would be self-defeating.
You know, Joan, when the post you did over at USNI blog a few weeks ago, where I first heard about this and hearing you mention it to me again, I agree with you completely. The huge silencing of opinion, whether directly or indirectly, because it's almost a threat. Well, that needs to be reviewed. That immediately is going to cut a high percentage of people from even making the effort, whether it's out of fear or not wanting to spend a lot of time on a subject and then having it go nowhere. And when I first read it, and as you're reaching up again, what came to my mind is, if this is really a direction that some incredibly, probably has a technical degree, very close-minded, my biases show themselves, I'm sorry. If this goes forward, it's hard for me to put my mind around a less American concept, something that is less likely to be proper in a representative republic. And it would be something that really, I think, would require congressional attention. And the question I have for you, and I occasionally throw this out because, you know, tenured professors are great, civilians out there talking are great, brave people in uniform staking out important positions are great, but really something at this level, it requires somebody in the House of Representatives or the Senate that you can look to as an advocate, somebody who has somebody on their staff that understands the importance of an issue and can drop a note, which can produce a letter, which can get things moving. Who do you see, and if you don't, that's a fine answer as well, but are there some members in either the House of Representatives or the Senate where you've seen have really expressed an interest in professional military education, whether it's the Naval War College or Navy Postgraduate School or other locations, that if this movement to do what would be, in essence, both a hard and a soft censorship, in my opinion, those are my words, would be perhaps a wedge or a resource that those who are concerned about this could go to put the appropriate political pressure on those that might be making this decision in the bureaucracy?
Well, unfortunately, not since Ike Skelton left. I don't see anyone who has made professional military education one of their important issues. And I think you've hit on a really critical point. The book that I wrote dealt primarily, not exclusively, primarily with what I called institutional issues, hiring practices, student happiness, the idea that everybody has to graduate. But as I continue to work on the issue, and another Naval War College former chair and I are writing a book chapter on higher governance issues in PME, it's there that I'm starting to see as many or more real issues. It's at the Joint Staff and at the MEC, the Military Education Coordination Council, where you have this network of basically good old boys who are dedicated to the status quo and feel that they can do this, that they, as one person told me in an email, that it can ignore the noise about PME, that things like my book and blog post and this radio broadcast cause, because there isn't anyone in Congress who's paying attention, and therefore their answer to pretty much any kind of substantive change is that's not the way we've always done it, and we really don't need to pay any attention to any of this critique because nobody's watching us. And I think that is a huge issue because so many of the people in these positions, which really make these critical decisions, have no idea what they're doing. They have no background in education. They probably have no teaching experience whatsoever. They don't anticipate the unintended consequences. I'm sure whoever came up with that bright idea of vetting publication out in Monterey is a fine individual and a good American who is trying to please their boss by showing action and just doesn't understand the subject matter that they're dealing with. I say in my book, it would be like putting me in charge of a helicopter squadron. I don't know what I'm doing. So when you put somebody who is really good at flying helicopters in charge of education, they're well-intended, but they just don't know what they're doing. Or they are wedded to the past because this is the way it's always been and this is their safety zone. So you get governance by overreaction with little oversight or no oversight by individuals in Congress. You know, quite frankly, they're busy with other things. Sequestration is, I think, the word of the day. And if it's not sequestration, it's Afghanistan, it's operations, it's fuel for the fleet. PME doesn't make the radar. And that allows, again, these well-intended but uninformed or wedded to the past individuals or the bureaucracy to run amok.
Eagle One, a little while ago, you were talking about how some of the students were a little risk averse with their publication, for fear that they would get some form of retribution. One of the questions in our chat room was out of a X number of papers written for classes each year at the War College, how many are published, and if we don't publish them all, or if students don't want them published, are we actually creating this risk aversion problem for people who don't want to stick their necks out, and down the road we see the same thing, they'll overreact to a crisis?
Well, at least I can only speak to the area that I know about, and in my department in National Security Affairs, we changed the policy while I was chair, so we don't put all the papers on DTIC, so that students don't have to be fearful that someone in their community or a superior officer will see their paper and they will face retribution for it. So the decision to publish a paper is strictly voluntary. We don't release any of their papers unless students want them released. Now, when I'm grading papers, if I feel students have a good idea, I will say this paper with revisions and editing can possibly be a publication. If you're interested, I'll be happy to help you, or something of that nature. Interesting, I had three students this year in my leadership class all write papers, that were on the same general topic. And it was I always learn from my students. They teach me as well. And one of the little things that I got a big chuckle out of this time was they were all telling me the expression ducks pick ducks and explaining it to me of, you know, when it goes to a promotion board, if it happens to be all aviators and an aviator comes up for promotion, well, ducks pick ducks, aviators pick aviators. And they all wrote variations on that theme. They wrote their papers on, we have to get away from this idea of ducks pick ducks. And I wrote on all of them because they were all three from different services, that I thought it would make a great publication for the three of them to get together and try to co-author a publication for maybe Joint Forces Quarterly, putting forth this perspective. And I don't know if they're going to or not, but they're interested. They're going to come in and talk to me about it. So I think there is an opportunity to put forth views if they want to, but nobody's put at risk. We have moved way past that idea of putting anyone at risk because we don't want them to not tackle a topic for fear of retribution.
You know, and the shame is there are a lot of senior leaders who, you know, I've talked to that really need to hear the last 5 minutes of this show, because they are thoroughly convinced that there is no potential for retribution, that very few people actually feel that. And when an institution such as the Naval War College has to create a system such as you've described just to try to get people to address some ideas that might be a little bit off center line, I think speaks volumes. And one of our guests, our favorite Turkish professional that joins us every Sunday, Jam, he brought up a good question that might play into this a little bit, is in the course of your experience with professional military education, there's been the rise of, for lack of a phrase, new media, new ways for people to get ideas, to find new ideas, to interact and to collaborate. Have you seen how that the new media, social media, ready access to the internet, has that impacted the intellectual development of officers that you've seen? And is there a downside to it in addition to any positive upsides you may have seen?
Well, that's a great question. And the short answer is there absolutely has been a huge influence of the new media. From my own perspective, to start with, I started writing about PME with a blog piece that ran on AOL Defense, and it got a huge response. Interestingly enough, the first response was not to me directly. It was a write-up that was circulated via email to a large group of individuals, and not to me. But of course, with email, anything you put in email is going to go where, you know, places you don't expect it to go, and it got back to me. So I wrote another blog piece responding to this clandestine attempt to basically refute what I was saying. And I've been able to keep my arguments at least still going and keep them percolating because I write on USNI blog, I write at AOL Defense, I write at Small Wars Journal, I write a book, I write an article. So there's many, many more outlets. I'm co-authoring an article right now with a colleague, Kevin Kelly, that we hope will be in Joint Forces Quarterly. You can keep things going. There are many, many more outlets. For the students, I think it's the same thing. There are so many more opportunities to voice your views, even if anonymously, that it's not the mechanisms that used to be in place to really squelch different perspectives. The lid's off, you know, Pandora's box is open. And as you pointed out before, Diane Major's quote, the power-pointed echo chamber has exploded. And what's really sad is the only place that still really is in place are at these upper, higher-level governance issues at the MEC and in the Joint Staff, where they all feel, you know, we can just ignore all this, we can just ignore all this noise, and we can just go on doing the things the way we've always done it because nobody's watching as well. Sooner or later, somebody's going to read something and get interested, at least that's my hope, and say, are we really doing this the best way we can? Are we really doing the best we can for the officers and for the country? And we owe that to them. So I'm convinced that it's the new media, if we stay in it long enough and get past sequestration, that some member of Congress is going to say, yeah, I need to take a look at this. Actually, the article that my colleague Kevin Kelly and I are writing is basically the outline for what a group that was looking at PME, what would be the issues that they would look at, and what would be the questions that they would ask. And Kevin is a retired military officer and a professor of longstanding. And he was able to really help me shape this into the kind of tasker that would go to a committee to look into the issue. So I hope that gets published, and I hope somebody reads it and says, yeah, let's do that.
When you get a student who writes a particularly good piece of work that you think ought to be published, do you go back to them and say, you know, you ought to submit an idea along this line to proceedings or some other external publication? And if you do that, is there additional review done on a student work that is going to be published externally?
Well, absolutely. Again, when I'm grading papers, that paper will just jump right out. And I always make it a point to pull the student aside and say, look, if you would like to try and write that for publication, I'd be happy to help you with it. The course I teach up at Harvard is a writing course. So besides writing myself, I've gotten pretty good at editing. So I always offer to, you know, edit the paper, to really work with them to shape the thesis and make it concise. And I know other professors do exactly the same thing. The faculty is really dedicated to the students. You know, this is something above and beyond what you see at most civilian academic institutions, the amount of devotion and care and time that faculty spend with students. And I think the students appreciate it in most instances. And if they're going to write for publication, you can bet before it goes out, there will have been at least one, probably more than one faculty member helping this person along the way. We also have at Naval War College a writing center, and our writing center has really taken the student writing forward because, quite frankly, a pretty high percentage of the students are not strong writers when they come into the classroom. That's not something they've been doing for 20 years. They haven't, in fact, they've been hindered because the only things that they've written have been PowerPoint slides or fitness reports, which, of course, sentences, paragraphs, and grammar don't really come into play. So writing a paper is often a new and challenging and sometimes frightening experience, but, yeah, the faculty work hand-in-hand with the students to really encourage those papers which have the potential to go forward.
I've got a laugh at it myself because you're talking about the course you had at Harvard and the Writing Center up in Newport. I'm going, are those available online? Can I watch them? Anybody, I think honestly, that's one of the, you know, we're talking about the barriers to people getting the ideas is sometimes you'll have somebody who's been maleducated. They've never been given it. They're very intelligent. They got lots of great ideas, but they've never really been shown how to put those in a format that transmits what's in their brain so other people can process it and move it. And it is something that comes with time, and everybody can be improved. And I know one of our regular guests here, Claude Berube, he publishes both fiction and nonfiction. I mean, there are writers groups where they just get together. These are published authors, and they try to help each other out. It is a challenge to do. And I'll get away from that topic because I'll spend 20 minutes talking about writing.
It's a good topic. You're absolutely right. Students, Naval War College students, PME students are not inherently strong writers. So the more we can do to help them, I think it will benefit everybody.
And here's a big pixel. When you look it back at periods between wars, and I think we're entering that right now, if we're not already in it. You look at the area between the Spanish-American War and World War One. Alfred Thayer Mahan's really highlighted spot there. If you look at the area between World War One and World War Two, especially with the developments of the iterative class of cruisers, the development of fast battleships, the development of carrier aviation, long-range submarines, a lot of heavy intellectual work was done between the wars to make sure that not only were the right lessons of previous conflicts intellectualized and inculcated into future plans, programs, and strategies, but they also were trying to look forward so they can see what the next wave is coming. And that's why our intellectual institutions are so critical, because the work that's done between conflicts avoids you having to learn things and develop ideas during war when you're paying in blood, bodies, and territory. And as we're coming into another post-conflict financial crunch, and as we're coming into another post-conflict area where we need to look forward to when our nation will be challenged again, which it will be, do we have the right type of political, intellectual, and uniformed leadership support to make sure that our areas of professional military education are going to be maintained, funded, and focused in such a way that between this set of wars, they'll be doing the same critical function they did before the other interwar periods?
Wow, that's a pretty big question. That has so many different facets to it. When I was chair, at least once a year, sometimes twice a year, the other department chairs and I would be called in and said, and told, the Navy wants metrics on return on investment. And we would look at whoever was telling us this and say, there is no such thing. And there is no such thing for a variety of reasons. You can measure training in metrics. You know, how long does it take to screw in that screw? How long does it take to get a plane off the ground? Those can be measured. Education, those same kind of measurements simply aren't possible. Furthermore, at PME institutions, this idea of return on investment is tainted by the fact that we have no control over our student body, who is part of our student body. Students are sent to us. There is no academic admissions test. We get a group of students. So how successful they are, you know, is partially a function of who comes in. Well, they said, that's okay. We'll measure promotion rates. Well, if the Navy is sending us individuals just before they retire, they're not going to be promoted. So that's going to affect our metrics. Now, that is happening less more recently, but for a while that was an issue. But the basic idea is educational value is difficult to measure. In a stringent economic period, people want more, not less, of metric proof of something being of value. And again, that's one of the reasons why I wrote this book, because it's my fear that if you can't provide these kind of metrics, that military education will be seen as low-hanging fruit in budget cuts, which would be exactly the wrong thing to do for all the reasons that you just cited. And I'm, as you were talking, I was flipping through my book. I have it in front of me, and I found a quote that I referred to earlier that's on the wall at the Naval War College. It's actually taken from the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, UNESCO Charter. And it says, since war begins in the minds of men, it is in the minds of men that defenses of peace must be constructed. And it's in this interwar period that these defenses of peace have to be constructed. But you're doing that in areas that these well-trained individuals may not be familiar with. So I would argue we need more and better education in these periods at a time when, again, metrics can't perhaps justify it in ways that the top brass would like. And, well, if we are going to educate, let's get people technically educated, seems to be the mantra that just won't go away. So that's a very long-winded and roundabout way of saying, again, I think the rhetoric is there. I hope the institutional support will follow that rhetoric, but I'm not 100% sure that's going to be the case.
I know the Commandant of the Marine Corps and the Chief of Naval Operations have recommended reading lists for their officers. So the Marines carry it all the way down to our lowest enlisted ranks. What would you recommend to a naval officer or a Marine officer who's going to attend the Naval War College? Has books he ought to be reading in anticipation of showing up at your institution?
Well, there are these reading lists, and you can start from those. That's always a good place to start. I would recommend biographies. In the leadership course that we teach, that we just finished, one of the things we do is try and have the students read, do case studies, and many of those include biographies, of leaders not just in the military, a good portion are, but some, you know, I hate this phrase, out of the box, but some out of the box thinkers. And the one that I'm thinking of right now is this year we did a case study on Steve Jobs, who we did it because the students last year really wanted this. And the students this year were horribly uncomfortable with that case study because he isn't a leader in the sense of a military leader. He doesn't have this kind of patriotic spirit and teamwork, and we all need to be fair. He was sometimes ruthless, sometimes not a particularly nice person, but yet he changed the world. And I think those kind of books can be very, very useful. Another book that comes to mind, it's interesting, it was on our reading list at the Naval War College. Our president, Admiral Weisskopf, put it on his reading list, and that was World War Z, which, of course, is now being made into a movie. It's gotten a lot of attention. Initially, there was a time a couple years ago when we wanted to use part of it in the classroom because it does have a great portion that talks about force planning. And force planning is something that the National Security Affairs Department deals with. And we were told, no, that that was not a good idea because the language in the book might be offensive to some students, and it really didn't portray the military very well. That, to me, was very disappointing.
Earlier on, you mentioned something I wanted to come back to here, because I think you can get opinions on either side of it. You know, Naval War College and its sister institutions, yes, they're part of the military, important part of the military, but they're also academic institutions that require an understanding of what the core purpose, the core mission, the ethos, the historical context of institutions of higher learning in the Western world, in order for them to really be able to function and do well and to keep good, motivated faculty, to get the most out of their students, et cetera, and so forth. And they're all headed by general officers or flag officers, not all of which have, believe it or not, an academic background or even an advanced degree. Have you seen a difference with the senior leaders that run these institutions who do or do not have advanced degrees, their ability to run these institutions? Is it really important for them to have an academic background, or is it a nice to have in order to have that institution run? And if for either answer, I have trouble understanding why we would have somebody there who doesn't have an academic background. What is the reasoning behind that from inside the lifelines where you are?
Well, that's a great point. I'm glad you brought that up. And I could answer better in about a year from now, because we have a new Naval War College president coming in this summer who does not have any graduate work. And this has become a source of great speculation at the War College as to why the Navy, did the Navy not consider it important that someone who headed a program that grants a master's degree did not himself have a master's degree. Past presidents that I have worked with, whether or not, well, they have had master's degrees, very few of them, none of them really, had any experience in academic administration. And that didn't make a difference. What made a difference was, did they have advisors who had academic administration experience, and were they willing to listen to those advisors? Admiral Shuford worked with the department chairs very, very closely, and he would listen to us. He would listen to, not necessarily always agree with us, but he would listen to our perspective. And it's at this second and third layer down, and this is an issue. The bureaucracy at the war colleges, not just the Naval War College, but war colleges generally, and academic institutions, but for our purposes in PME, has just expanded exponentially. I am a senior professor. Between me and the president of the Naval War College, there are one, two, three, six layers of bureaucracy. Six people between me and the president. So the chances of him ever having a conversation with me are slim to none. And the people in that six layers, very few, sometimes none, have any background in academic administration. That's not to say they're not academics or have a PhD, but they have never done the kind of curriculum development, hiring, promotion, tenure reviews that become part of keeping the faculty, as you pointed out, keeping a civilian academic faculty. So what's really important is not whether or not the president has an advanced degree, because I do think the war colleges should be run by military officers. They're military institutions. What's important are, do his advisors have the right background, and does he listen to them? Again, not always agree with them, but is there a forum for discussion with those academics and with those who have experience in academic administration? Too often, I mean, in meetings with individuals where we would try, me and other civilian academics who do have this kind of background, when we would try and explain how a tenure process was run, how a promotion process was run, the typical answer would be, well, I called somebody and they told me this is how it's done. And the process that would be described would be nothing that would ever be used in a civilian academic institution. I don't know who they called, and that was never disclosed, but you need people with experience, and that is the very clearly, it's the exception rather than the rule.
Well, as we wind down, we've discussed some of the educational aspects. I think another vitally important aspect of the War College is the networking and the commonality of experience that graduates would have. How valuable do you think that is?
Absolutely, and that's the kind of thing, there is an argument that we hear over and over, close the War Colleges, just send all the officers to a civilian academic institution. And that is a bad answer. Number one, it would be impossible for the really top-notch institutions where they have the kind of programs that the officers need in security studies to integrate that many officers. So what would happen is officers would end up going to a school where they would take courses that would be totally inappropriate and really not useful for them. So that's the first thing. The second is, it's only in the war colleges where you get this interaction between officers from different services, from different, even within the Navy, where you'll have somebody from a submarine sitting next to an aviator, sitting next to a SWO. So you really, this networking, this getting this joint perspective is a key part of PME, why we have to keep the war colleges open and just do the best job we can. And we're doing a good job, but we can always do better. And there are many things we can do fairly easily if we could just push this institutional inertia out of the way to really make these institutions. I always say, when an officer has the choice of going to Harvard, Princeton, or one of the war colleges, and picks the war college or the program that it offers, then we've done our job.
Amen. And we're up to about 90 seconds left, and I just want to throw a couple things your way. First of all, I wanted to obviously thank you for spending time with us this afternoon. I could easily go another hour. I'm looking at my list of questions I was going to ask you, and I keep coming up with new ones as opposed to asking the ones I planned for, which is always a good sign of a good show. But also, if you could, for the listeners, remind them again what you're working on. They could expect to see from you soon. And kind of a self-indulgent question I have here is, if you got the new Secretary of Defense, Hagel, in front of you, and he looked at you and said, Dr. Johnson Freeze, what would you really like for me to expand at the Naval War College? What would you tell him?
What would I like him to expand?
Yeah, what area of study or concentration or the way they do business at the War College, if you could give it a sustainable additional wedge of funds, you would like to see that put towards?
Well, I think we're doing the right curriculum. I think we've got it. I mean, there's only so much time. In 10 months, if you put something in, you have to take something out. The first thing I would encourage him to look at would be the premise that students who come in all graduate with both their PME, their JPME, and their master's degree. I would want a two-track program which really allows students to come in, and everybody's going to get their JPME qualification, but if you want a master's degree, you sign up for it, and you do different kinds of work, and there's the possibility that you will flunk out, just like there is in any other institution, without it ruining your career. That would allow the faculty to really increase the rigor in the curriculum and really, really ramp it up for those students who want and are willing to put the time in for it.
Excellent. And again, thank you very much for spending the last hour with us. I really look forward to an opportunity sometime down the road to talk to you again, specifically because of your other book that you had out on aerospace and space security issues. That's an area near and dear to my heart that had a couple of those questions. But thank you very much. It's been a very pleasurable hour.
Thank you. It's a pleasure for me, too.
Thank you for me, too.
And thank you, everybody, who was joining us live or getting us on the archive. I hope everybody's had a great St. Patrick's Day. Please join us again for another episode of MidRats. Until then, have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Yeah.